Book session number 13232, Reel 3.
Major Campbell, Reel 3. So, the Japanese have landed, you're in charge of the carrier platoon, then you were transferred back to your own company. What happened from then on, as far as you can remember?
Well, as far as I can remember, it's almost a nightmare now to think about it. I arrived up with the CO and several people attached to battalion headquarters, other ranks in other words, and here we were presented with a situation where there were people struggling ashore across this rather wide creek, mangrove swamp type of creek, and we were asking what's happened, and they said, oh, terrible things happened because the boat has lost its propeller and we can't get people across and a lot of people can't swim. Well, then we were confronted by a number of chaps swimming ashore, basically wearing perhaps a pair of shorts or shorts and a shirt, most of them totally unarmed. I mean, everything had gone, you know, there was nothing you could do about it. People had drowned, and we dragged all these people ashore. And then the CO got everybody together. And I can't remember, but I fancy the reserve company, and I can't remember which one it was also with the CO. And I can remember we all trudged off down this track towards the rear because the brigade commander had given orders to withdraw. And it was coming down in buckets with rain. It was like walking through a swamp. And everybody was absolutely soaked to the skin. And I can't say that anyone was feeling particularly cheerful. And we went several miles. And I said to the CO, look, I better try and get the remainder of my company and what we've got left, those armed and unarmed, back down to Chondong, where with the camp where we'd been stationed, and I went off. But after I'd gone, and I did get back to that camp, and we got them reclothed and re-kitted out and so forth and so on, the CO, as far as I recollect, and it is well documented in the regimental history, he picked up, I think, a number of men who'd got detached from their regiments, the 17th Dogras, and he combined them with what chaps he'd got with him, and they got involved in a series of most horrendous incidents with the Japanese. And at one stage, there was an American who'd been posted to our regiment, a chap called Eugene Pomeroy, a good chap. I can't remember how he came to the regiment, but he'd certainly, I think he'd originally been in Shanghai. But anyway, he in some mysterious manner managed to get through with a carrier and contacted the CO, and he may well have got one or two wounded chaps away, but they were involved in a series of incidents in this kampong or village surrounded by paddy fields in the pouring rain with the Japanese, and the CO managed in the end to get these chaps through, but I think it involved leaving quite a number of wounded men in this village because we simply couldn't get them away and hoped the Japanese would treat them respectfully.
Then what do you remember happening after that?
I remember going back and we got ourselves re-equipped. And we... The CO then eventually appeared with the remainder of this force, and the battalion was sort of put together again, and by that time the whole brigade had been withdrawn, and then it was a, a a series of withdrawals down the main road to Railhead. Now, this was a tricky situation because Railhead was a single, I think, track line which came up many miles from the middle of Malaya, and the fear was that a few accurate bombs and the whole brigade would be totally cut off, but it didn't in fact happen. And we were involved in a series of rearguard actions during this thing. I remember one particular instance when a position was picked up with a sort of canal type stream with a bridge over it with open paddy in front, and we got into positions for the night, and I remember distinctly getting hold of a patrol led by a Pathan Havildar, and I told him exactly what I said. I want you to go out in front, see if you can work your way through part of the paddy and see if you can make contact with any of the Japanese advanced troops. And it was then getting dark, and I waited some time, and the patrol came back, and I can't remember who, someone came to me and said, the patrol's back, Sam. And I said, oh, where are they? And they said, here. And there they were, and I said, where is Havildar, whatever his name was, I can't remember now. And then they said, oh, Sam, Margir, which means he's been killed. And I said, but where is he? Oh, they said, oh, Kate Kebich Mehai, which means he's out in the middle of the fields. I said, well, you're to send two men out and to bring him back. Go and get him. And I waited, and they went off, and after some time they came back, and someone called out and said, Sabo Agia, which means they're back. And I said, where are they? And they said, here. And I said, have you collected him? And they said, yes. I said, where is he? And someone had shone a torch down at my feet, and there was this chap lying on the ground with a bullet trail straight through the middle of his forehead, which didn't do me any particular good at the time, I can tell you. Following that, the next morning, there was some very heavy sniping going on, and it was apparent that there was a whole pile of wood that looked rather like hop poles almost immediately off our front line on the canal bank, and somebody, the CA, was standing with me, and we were about 100 yards behind, and he said, my God, he said, there are some Japanese snipers in that pile of wood. And he said, come on, we're going to go and get those. So he went roaring off, and I followed him along. And there was a carrier had gone up onto this bridge, and he called out and said, give me a box of grenades. And these were handed over the side, and there we were, sort of on the edge of this thing with grenades being hurled into this heap of wood. And after a few fairly loud bangs, the CO said, I think we've got them, and told two chaps to sort of fix bayonets and go forward. And they pulled several dead Japanese out of this heap of woodwork. So that was an incident for you there.
Where was that?
I can't remember the name of the place, but it was halfway between... Can you turn it off for me? We were some, 5 miles north of Quala Krai, and we took up another position there, and it was not very satisfactory because we were in the middle of rubber estates. So it meant that at night the Japanese would come forward, and I don't think people had probably realised at that stage that their great trick was to climb up the trees about 100 yards off your front, and they'd be firing from the tops of the trees, and people thought the shooting was coming from the ground. Of course, you'd open fire at ground level. And additionally, at times, they had explosive bullets, which, if they fired a shot, you heard it, and a few seconds later, there was a crack behind you, and people began to get the impression that they were surrounded. But anyway, this little action took place at night, and people got a bit trigger happy, and tracer was flying all over the place, and it was decided at that point that all ranks should only be issued with 5 rounds of ammunition at night, and that if that was expended, you relied on your bayonets to stop anybody And they also had these rather unpleasant little, what we call bang bang guns. They were sort of little things they pulled along the road on wheels by hand, the infantry, sort of 2-pounder infantry guns, which were sort of whiz bangs that sent stuff flying all over the country. Well, we withdrew from that position, and the following night it rained like hell all night long. We were absolutely soaked. And I'd had this ulcerated knee, and it was beginning to go on me again. And then I got the most appalling fever. And I said to my subedar, "I just cannot go on, Saab." And he said, "Well, you better go and see the doctor." And I did. And I was pushed down to Railhead, and they said, "You better be out of here for a bit." And I got put on a hospital train. I didn't want to go on a hospital train, but the next thing was I found myself on a hospital train being sent down to a hospital in Singapore, where I spent about a fortnight, and then I came back and joined the battalion again further down the line.
Whereabouts did you rejoin them?
Maps. Quite old. Well, after I came out of hospital, I rejoined the battalion one afternoon between Sir Garmont and Clewang, and I remember we went up from the end of Railhead, which was getting shorter and shorter, and I took a truck and I went up, and I remember finding the battalion, and just as we were about to sort of disembark from the bus and go into battalion headquarters, which was in the middle of a rubber estate, some low-flying jet planes came over, and I thought, God, that's it, we've had it, but they didn't see us. And I spoke to Jeff Hawkins, who was then acting CO, because the CO had been wounded by that time at Quanten. You know, the chap had got to VC, Arthur Cumming, he'd gone, he was badly wounded. And he said, "Well, good, you've arrived just in time. I think we've got something on today." He said, "We're going to set up a really good ambush for these people." And the road coming down from Sir Garmont to Clewang led through it one place, through jungle and a deep cutting. And he'd arranged it so that he'd have a listening post about a mile up the road with two chaps just with hidden in the hedge with a field telephone in communication with battalion headquarters. And then on the far side of this S-bend, he'd put a company of chaps armed with Thompson submachine guns and grenades. And then into the reverse slope, we'd got some Bren guns and some more grenadiers and so forth and so on. And behind us, we had got a company of the 18th Gowal Rifles. And the intention was that if they were accompanied by tanks, that we'd let the tanks go through, everybody'd lie low, and then we'd take on the infantry and the cutting. But in the event, what happened was that the telephone bell rang and everybody stood too. And within about 5 minutes, we were looking down into this S-bend, and around the corner came about 20 Japanese on bicycles, as if they were out on a cycling holiday in Japan, all talking it with each other and jabbering away. What we didn't see was a large number, I suppose, I don't know, nearly a battalion, I don't know what their battalion strength would have been, but perhaps 600, I think, infantry following them up. And it was an unfortunate thing that just as they came round the reverse side of the S-bend, a young Sikh Bren gunner coughed, and one of these Japs looked up, and he jumped off his bicycle, and he started shouting, and he started running. Well, it didn't do him an awful lot of good, because they got a whole of a Bren magazine into them, and the whole lot went down. And then the infantry who were marching in the cutting and couldn't get up the banks were taken on by the company armed with Sten guns and Thompson submachine guns and various things, and I believe there were severe casualties there. And then the companies following them up were taken on by the 3-inch mortars, and we had a battery of 25 Padres laid on, who fired at the rear guard and fired on both sides of the road, so they couldn't spread out. And I think it's a fact to say that that stopped their advance. Stone dead for two whole days, they didn't appear again. Parallel to this road was a railway line, and a colleague of mine with two or three, a couple of platoons was guarding the railway. I don't think he got much involved, and I think a few shots were fired, but he then withdrew down the railway. And the unfortunate thing about this was that the plan had been very carefully laid. We were to withdraw to a certain point, trucks were waiting, everybody was to be picked up. But unfortunately the companies who were to attack from the cutting, the company there, was to withdraw into the jungle and round. The maps were totally inadequate, and the company, having gone a certain distance, ran into a complete mangrove swamp and were lost completely. And although Hawkins, the CO, got permission from Brigadier to wait till late at night with two or three trucks to pick them up, all these chaps, including the officers, although they didn't die, we know that for a certain fact, because they were POWs, were totally lost to the regiment from that point onwards. So, you know, great success and then great grief.
What do you remember happening next?
We were then withdrawn back to Kluang, and we took up a position there, and this was overlooking the railway, and we were dug in there for several days, and during the course of it, this I was asked to take some chaps down and do as much damage as I could to the local power station. Well, I'm not an engineer officer, so I had little idea, so armed with sledgehammers and grenades, I went down there and smashed every dial I could in sight, and we hurled grenades about this place and hoped to crack all the iron castings on the generators and things, and we certainly effectively put all the lights on the place out, but I don't think it probably took skilled engineers more than several weeks to put the thing right again. Thereafter, things began to go really bad, because it was at this point that it was decided, right or wrongly, I don't know, that the Australians should withdraw down the road in trucks, and the 26th and the 8th Brigade should leapfrog each other down the railway without any transport. And on the first night we were there, despite patrolling, we were bypassed well out in the night by an absolute continuous stream of lorries, which must have been had hundreds of Japanese troops on board, going past us and getting down across the railway between us and the other brigade. And when we had instructions to withdraw, we hadn't gone very far, but we were completely stopped by this roadblock. In fact, General Barstow, the divisional commander, was so concerned that he came up with two of his senior staff officers walking up the railway and was ambushed, and he was killed. And we then had to take to the jungle for about the better part of a week without any food, carrying wounded men. And this was a horrendous walk, because we had absolutely damn all to eat. The only occasion we found anything to eat was in one deserted kampong, where we found some rice and we managed to cook up a meal of rice. And on another occasion we ended up, because of Japanese aircraft overhead, lying in the middle of a pineapple plantation full of half-ripe pineapples, which everybody devoured with vigour, and till their mouths felt as if they'd been eating sulfuric acid, and their lips were so sore you could hardly speak. And this withdrawal went on for at least two more days, and at one stage, my battalion was down to practically no men at all now, and on one occasion we'd been dragging on all day, we were dragging on through the night, they decided to call a halt, and I and a brother officer of mine were told to wait there, because when they came up, they'd put certain people here and certain people there, and unregrettably, it's all reported in the regimental history that he and I just sat down, and the next minute we were asleep. We just went flat out. And, well, it didn't make any difference, because we went on the next day, and halfway through the next day, we ran into a detachment of Japanese troops, and the Sikhs in the Sikh regiment panicked, and half of them surrendered. I think they thought they were Gurkhas at first, and then lost their heads. And because brigade headquarters, to mark its position within the formation, had got a white flag, the Sikhs thought they were surrendering. And we ended up a few miles behind Johor Bahru, which, as you know, is the sort of bridgehead on the causeway over to Singapore. There were a few chaps from the Gwalis left. There were a few Sikhs. There was a brigade commander, Brigadier Parkin, well, Colonel Parkin, who incidentally got a DSO because he'd taken over, because the brigade commander, Brigadier Painter, had had a stroke and was totally out of action. And here we were, and Parkin was suggesting that we should all get ourselves killed by doing a glorious attack on the back of Kota Bahru. Not Kota Bahru, sorry, Johor Bahru. Nobody actually thought this was a very brilliant idea. And so Jeff Hawkins went to Colonel Parkin and said, look, we've got no men at all now. There are just four of us or whatever. We would like to be able to, if we could, make our way through the Japanese lines and get back to Singapore Island. And he agreed. And so we set off at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was getting dusk later on, and we were walking on a compass bearing, really, and we walked and walked and we walked. And then it was night, and then we came to a road, I can remember.
Came to what?
Came to a main road running out from Johor Bahru towards a place called Kota Tinggi. And we were standing in broad moonlight, and someone said, Christ, there's somebody coming up this bloody road. And we all lay down flat on our faces, and we couldn't have been more than 15 feet from the edge of the road. And we were, you know, there was sort of scrub and stuff behind us, but we were in absolutely open. We put our faces down, our hands over our heads, and a whole company of Japanese cycle troops, about 50 of them, cycled past us at about that range and never saw us. Well, once they were past, we said, come on, boys, let's get going. And we ran like hell across the road, hid in the rubber the other side of the road. They heard our feet crossing the road. Some of them stopped and came back, and we stood behind the trees waiting, possibly taking a hopeless pot shot with a pistol at them, but they never appeared. They disappeared. And then on we went, and we were getting tireder and tireder, and eventually we came to the edge of a sort of mangrove swamp. And we found some Chinese, two or three Chinese chaps living in a hut there. They didn't speak English, we certainly didn't speak Chinese, but by hand signals, you know, so forth and so on, we explained who we were. And they gave us a meal of coffee and rice and things, and really got us on our feet again, for which, if I remember rightly, we were carrying still some of the money left from the regimental treasure chest, or the CO was. And he gave this money to the Chinese and explained that we wanted to get back to Singapore Island. Well, between us and Singapore Island, there was an enormous great estate with a road leading right down it. But in the immediate vicinity, there was a village filled with slightly drunken, I would think, Japanese troops who were firing off shots in the air and dancing about. And I'm glad to say these crafty Chinamen managed to lead us through and around this village, and we were never seen. And we made our way down.
How many of you were there?
If I remember rightly, four. Four. And we eventually got down to the coast, and there were the Straits of Johor, and there was Singapore Island, and just over there, not 2 miles away, was the naval base. And in the naval base was sitting at least one British destroyer. And here are a lot of local boats lying on the beach. Good, we'll get one of these and paddle across. They'd all been smashed by our people before they withdrew onto the island, so there was no form of transport at all. We can't swim that distance in our state. We couldn't anyway, probably. What are we going to do? So Jeff Hawkins said, well, I'll have one more go. And fortunately, he'd got a torch with us. And fortunately, also, he'd been the regimental signals officer at one time. So he looked in the direction of the naval base, and he started signalling. And within about 15 seconds, an oldest lamp began flashing back us across the straits. He said who we were, and within a quarter of an hour, a naval motor launch came over and picked us up. And 5 minutes later, or 10 minutes later, we found ourselves filthy, dirty, stinking, unwashing, dead tired, sitting in the wardroom of a British destroyer having a drink and saying, thank God for that.
Who were the other two, apart from you and Hawkins?
I can't remember now. I think there was a chap called Brunner, and he's long since dead. He was an ECO. But I can't remember who the fourth one was. It's completely gone from me now. Totally gone. Anyway, there we were, and they gave us something to eat, and, you know, we were more or less saying, do you chaps realise that they're only just over there? I don't think anybody in the island had the slightest idea what was going on. Anyway, we were whisked away to a reinforcement camp near Changi. One run by a splendid piece of, I don't want to insult him, dinosaur furniture with a well-known Indian army name, Pine Coffin, Colonel Pine Coffin of the Punjabis, who we used to know as old Colonel Oakchest, you know. Anyway, here we found 100 or a couple of hundred reinforcements with some officers who'd been sent over from India, absolutely green to the whole thing, and recruits who I think the most they'd done is probably fired perhaps 25 rounds on the ranges. They didn't know how to use automatic weapons or anything. They could just fire rifles. Well, these were all co-opted together, and we were sent up, and the battalion was sort of reformed. And we were joined on to, and they were in a decimated state too, the 47th, which were the 5th Battalion of the Sikh Regiment. So we became a composite battalion under Colonel Parkin. But the story went, which I think is rather a splendid one, that General Wavell got very hot under the collar when he was out there and seemed to think that nobody had been making a very great effort, but I don't think he quite realised what the situation was. And Colonel Pine Coffin had been ordered, because of their proximity to the north shore of the island, to remove this reinforcement camp, or the remains of it, with all its Indian followers, sweepers, cooks, and God knows what there, and a certain amount of small arms ammunition, to another site, I know not where, but they were all handed out with a rifle and a box of ammunition before them, and someone led the way. They were not military personnel at all, and so